on the Tan Talk Radio Network.
This is the Tan Talk Radio Network.
With a Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book. Coming to you from glorious Clearwater, Florida, the perfect place for writers to write and readers to enjoy a good book. Oh boy, it was a little nippy today. I actually heated my car seat. You know, I have that feature in the car, and I rarely use it, and it was funny. I used it today, which is really silly because it's not that cold here. It is beautiful here in Florida, the perfect place, very sunny, wonderful day. And if you are interested in saving bills, your electric bills, you should go solar and go EHS. That's one of our sponsors. But right now, first, I want to say that at the bottom of the hour, I have a fascinating guest, Karen Grassel. You don't probably recognize the name, but you've heard about her and you've seen her a million times. She was Ma on Little House in the Prairie, and she has written a memoir, and I'm looking forward to talking to her later on in the program. But first, I want to turn to somebody who, you know, I always tell people, paint a picture when you're writing, really, and this is particularly for all you people who are still sort of in the middle of NaNoWriMo, and you say, what should I do? And you're sending me all these queries. What should I do? How can I make my book more interesting? I said, tell me about where you are. Make me feel like I am there. Well, my author, the next author I have is, boy, she has done that, and she has done a great job of it. Patricia Dunn is from the Bronx, and she takes us there in this last stop on the 6. Hi, Patricia.
Hi, thank you for having me. I was actually a big Walton fan, so it's a very exciting interview you have coming up next. So
yes, yes, it is. I was excited, too, to get this book, and I'm looking forward to talking to Karen. But boy, oh boy, when I got your book, let's just say it's an Italian-American book, which I could really appreciate a lot of the humor and a lot of the events in the book. But, of course, this is set in the Bronx, where you are from. You know, when I was a kid, I worked in an Italian restaurant. I grew up stirring the spaghetti sauce. My cousin was married to an Italian, and her daughter and I were the same age, and we worked in the kitchen, and so we had lots of experience.
Okay, I'm sure you have.
Oh boy. So you know what it's like to be in a big Italian family. Tell us about this book and the story, how you came about writing this story. It's called The Last Stop on the 6.
Well, first of all, thank you for having me on your show. I'm very excited. I started writing this 25 years ago, but I will say for all the nano writers, people that are writing novels, it doesn't have to take 25 years. I finished it and then put it into the virtual drawer and took it out a couple of years ago because I think after teaching writing all these years, I could, it's kind of autobiographical, but I had to be the writer I am today to be able to fictionalize it enough to kind of get to the truth, I think, that I wanted to tell. I started writing it in a writing MFA program, and it was a collection really of short stories. And then I will confess, I wanted to get into this novel class because I loved the instructor. And when they asked me, are you writing a novel? I said, yes. So I just kind of happened that way. But the story took its on its own life, and the characters did the same. I mean, I know that's a cliche to say, follow your characters, they'll take you where they need to go. But that did very much happen with the story. And it's placed on a young woman who leaves home after she thinks she caused an accident that causes her brother to be paralyzed. and she runs off to L.A., and she can't save him, and so she tries to save the world by being this political activist. And on it takes place on the 3 days before we're supposed to go to war with the Iraq the first time. It's kind of funny that I'm even saying the first time with the first President Bush. And then she gets a letter from her mom right after she's been arrested at a protest. She gets home, and the mom says, "You got to come home. She hasn't been home in 10 years. Your brother's getting married, and you owe him." And she'd rather go back to jail. But she does go home, and then all the kind of chaos and all the nutty love and craziness happens, but she's really afraid to face this brother that she was very close to but hadn't talked to in 10 years, and he's not there. But nobody seems to know where he is or wants to talk about it. So she kind of sets out on this like journey to figure out like where is she really from. She learns more about her neighborhood, realizing she has more of the stereotypes in her head than really existed. And she gets to know more of her family in a way that she never, you know, thought that she knew, and herself eventually at the end. But the answer, can you go home again, is you can, but your expectations may be very, very different than what you actually will realize. And that's what I think she finds out by the end of the book. So,
well, tell us about this main character and how much of it is you. As I said, I enjoyed when I started reading it, and I was reading the first page. I got a kick out of it, actually. Thinking back to my own protest days, I don't know anymore.
Yeah.
Oh gosh.
I understand that. Oh gosh. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
When we thought we could do everything, change the world, now you're like, well.
I know. And I don't know. Somehow, our protest seems so much more fun than what's happening today. I could read it with a little bit. I don't think I could read anything today on current situations. But tell us about Angela.
So Angela is a little bit based in terms of the, I mean, I moved out to L.A. kind of blindly. I did have a brother who was an actor as a child. And his nickname was, when you're in the Bronx, everybody, especially Pelham Bay, has a nickname. So they used to call him Wood for Hollywood. But I went out to Hollywood, which was nothing like people expected Hollywood to be. You know, it was like very run down. And I lived in a small studio apartment, and people would hear this noise in the background when they called from New York and said, "Oh, I hear the ocean." And it was the 110 freeway. It was literally my backyard. So I moved out there, and I got, politically active from various things. And actually, that's the full of the story, but I won money on a game show, wound up going to Nicaragua to build houses with the Sandinistas, but that's another book. Anyway, but I was an activist, and I came home once or twice in the 12 years I was out there, but not much. But when I came home, it was very much, it took a lot for me to, like, you know, I mean, my family, you know, loving the characters based on some of the characters in the book, but I had a lot of ideas about who they were, and they had ideas about who I was, and it took a while to kind of get to know that I was more alike and had more in common with my family than I thought, and that they realized, oh, okay, she isn't so out there and weird like we thought she was. So that's kind of...
Gee, that sounds familiar to me.
Yeah, right? Right? So it's like... But, the only character that is very, very true and maybe bigger than life that I did not really lean into fictionalizing more is the mother character in the book. And when people, like, I've had several people that have read the book before they met the character of the mother. And when they meet my mother, they'll say, wow, I've never met a character in real life that's more over the top than the character in a book. And I said, yeah, that's Mom. Mm-hmm. So when I was younger, if you said you're just like your mother, that would have been an insult. Now I feel like, oh, I wish I could be just like my mother. Because, you know, she kind of gets things done in her own way. So it is based on my story, but it goes a little bit in other directions, you know.
Oh, lots of things to discover. And as you say, the characters do sometimes just take you exactly where they want to go. There's nothing you can do about
exactly.
it.
Exactly. Like, you know, Billy was the one character that was fictionalized and a composite of many people. He's the artist in the book who also helps the father, and he's an exterminator, but then he becomes this artist that makes bug art. And that was one of my favorite scenes to write, like this whole gallery of
Well, we won't go into that, but it's interesting. There are a couple of very memorable scenes. That, and I love also the tuxedo ones.
But it's funny because it is an Italian. The press, Bordighera Press. They publish Italian American literature because they try to get that out there, and I love them and appreciate them so much. But I had. Somebody read the book, write to me, and said, oh, I know this family, and I'm married into it. I married into it twice. And it was so nutty to me how close this family you wrote is, just like the family I know. And then I wrote back to the person and said, oh, did you marry into an Italian-American family? And he's like, no, they're Creole. So I was like, oh. So I get a lot of letters and people telling me, I'm not Italian American, but my family is like this as well, because I think it's all about like families, that tend to be loving but loud. And because we're so loud, everyone thinks that we're letting the world know all that's out there. But we just put everything on the table. But there's a lot of secrets that we hold back, and that's where the navigation happens for this kind of book and for people who live in these families or even in these neighborhoods. I grew up in Pelham Bay, which is the last stop on the 6. Unless you're from Pelham Bay in the Bronx, then it's the first stop. And everybody was always screaming into the street, telling everybody what they thought was everybody else's business. But there were all these things happening behind closed doors that we didn't, know about. So that's, I think, was also part of wanting to write this book. What are the things that people don't say that really have big impacts on their lives without them even realizing it?
Well, it is funny. Now, I grew up in northern Michigan, and my family background is mostly Finnish, and Finnish, Jewish, Swedish. So we're a much more quiet people, particularly the Finnish part. We don't talk a lot. So when my cousin married an Italian, we were brought into a world that we never experienced.
Yeah, so my first husband, my second husband was Jewish from New York. So he kind of had that experience a little bit, but my first husband had a more quiet family, only child. And as much as he loved my family, and also he's still very close to my family because it's like once you're in, you're never out. He was like, what is going on here? And everybody I would bring home from college would say, why is everybody yelling and screaming? And I'm like, and I would have to stop and say, who's yelling and screaming? And then I'd realize, oh, that's just the way people talk. So it was just it's a shock if you don't know it. But
yeah.
I'm not very shocked. But like you said, I have a friend who happens to be Finnish also, and her family is like very quiet and subdued. And you don't just like talk over each other and listen at the dinner table, and I was like, what's going on here? Is everybody mad at each other? And she said, why would you think that? I'm like, because nobody's like yelling at each other. So it depends. Your perspective is very interesting based on where you grow up.
It is. And as I said, I got to work in the restaurant. It was Gino's restaurant. And I got, we started off, my cousin and I, we started off washing dishes, and then we graduated.
I experienced that too, the dishes to the bus girl. Finally got to the waitress.
It was so much fun, and that kitchen was so noisy. They were always yelling. We had two people there, Gino and Mario, and they yelled back and forth. They never stopped. I don't know. Their voices
even if they crossed the, I remember working in restaurants too, or even my home, people like yell across the room and like, well, why are you yelling? You could just walk the 5 feet and just talk. And it's like, who's yelling? What do you want? That's how I talk. It's just very funny. I remember when I came back from LA and moved home and I was in my parents' house, I suggested they put in an intercom.
Because
at this point, they moved out of the apartment and they had two floors of a house. And I said, instead of yelling, Ma, instead of yelling downstairs, why don't you get an intercom? And they looked at me like I was insane. They were like, why would we need an intercom? We can hear each other. And I'm like, okay, never mind. So I didn't even suggested it.
Yeah, they do not need an intercom. I can tell my my cousins do not need, the neighbors can hear them. Let's put it this way.
Yeah. No, I know. But see, so if you grow up in a neighborhood where everybody's doing the same, nobody notices it. But where I live now, even though there's, Stamford, Connecticut's where I moved recently, and there are a lot of, there are more Italians in Stamford than I think there are in parts of Italy. But then my, neighborhood that's very close around me, people are not, like, loud like that. So every once in a while, we've had neighbors that got to know us, but they would say, they'd come over and they'd say, is everything okay? And I'm like, why? There's a lot of screaming and yelling. And I'm like, oh, we were just talking. I'm sorry. So we have to be aware of that because even though, my current husband happens to be Jewish, but he's from Queens, that's what we do. We yell without realizing it. So when I hear that people are saying, why are you screaming? It's like,
Well, I think people will enjoy reading this book. It's called Last Stop on the Six, and it's by Patricia Dunn. And I wanted to have time here for you to mention your webpage and about something that you do to help writers.
So my website is patriciadunnauthor.com. And you can find out more information about the book and writers. But I also am a writing coach, and I teach writing. I was a director of a writing institute at a college called Sarah Lawrence College, and now I work at the Westport Writers Workshop. And I work somewhat with occasionally high school students, but mostly with adult students, people who are parents or lawyers or doctors who want to write their books and want to tell their stories. And so I actually help people do that. And I think now my count of people I've had published is probably about 47. So I'm proud of that. But really, what I do is, I call myself a writing teacher, but I basically help writers do what I need. I help them get out of their way.
Well,
Yeah,
I looked at your website. Yeah. I looked at the testimonials that you have there. It's fascinating. And everybody, go and check out Patricia Dunn, author.com, and you can find out more about this book.
Yeah, and you can write me, too.
And you can write to her. My goodness, she likes to read.
Yeah, I do like to hear from people, especially people I don't know.
Okay, well, Patricia, I think that you've written a book that really tells a fascinating story. And when we talk about painting a picture in words, you do it. And you make us feel like we're in the Bronx.
Thank you so much. So everybody comes to the Bronx, get the book, and keep writing. Although you're writing your novel this month, and then.
Oh, I'm so happy. A couple years ago, my goddaughter, Kanisha, insisted that I should do NaNoWriMo, and I did it, and I had so much fun doing it. And I've been getting emails since the beginning of the month. I've been getting emails from people saying, I did this, I did 1,000 words, I did, they're so excited.
That's all it takes, even just 10 minutes a day, NaNoWriMo, you can get that draft. Please tell all your listeners, if they want to write, they don't have to do it alone. They should find groups and people that get them as writers, just another friend.
Exactly. And find that joy on paper that I'm always talking about.
Yes, it is. It can be joyful.
It is joyful. And I'm sure that, I know that you've gotten great reviews on this book, and thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you so much. Thank you. I appreciate it.
It's been fun. Bye-bye now.
Thank you. Have a great day. Bye, everyone.
Okay, bye. All right. Well, I wanted to mention NaNoWriMo anyway, because I have been getting emails from people, and I want to thank everybody for those emails and for all of you who are participating and letting me know, because one of the things that, of course, I love to do here is to promote writers. And recently, I announced that I'm going to be giving out awards for the 7th anniversary of Joy on Paper, and they're going to be called the Patsy Awards. What else? Patsy with a Z. And I've been working on that, and thanks to Jim Lamb, who did a wonderful press release, we've gotten some great coverage on that. So I'm going to have up on my website, starting this weekend, I'm going to have a special place where you can go and you can tell me your favorite authors and the authors that have been on the program and why they should be winners of the Patsy Award, which will be announced on the program March 15th, 2022. Can you believe that already? It's going to be 2022. Well, let's hope that it'll be a better year, and it'll be the first year of the Patsy Awards. And I want to thank again Jim Lamb for the press release. And the wonderful thing about the press release, it also featured Jim Lamb and his literary gems, which are very helpful to all of the NaNoWriMo people who are working on their books, and they can discover new words and parts of writing that they might not know about, and they can find that on the website. It's radio-joy on paper, and just go to Jim Lamb's page. It's Literary Gems, and we will have one later in the program. And also, Devon Miller is featured, and Rita Moreau is featured. And again, I thank all of them for everything that they do for me. And then there's a special person I want to thank also. And I want to thank George, because George has been a big supporter of Joy on Paper. And I want to play a special song for George today before we go to commercial. So let's play the whole song, Ed. We'll play the song, and at the end, we'll go to commercial. And then I'll be back with Karen Grassel, the mother from Little House on the Prairie.
For all those times you stood by me, for all the truth that you made me see, for all the joy you brought to my life, for all the wrong that you made right, for every dream you made come true, for all the love I found in you, I'll be forever thankful, baby. You're the one who held me up, never let me fall. You're the one who saw me through
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Are you ready to eliminate your home energy bill? Well, get ready to harness the sun. Go EHS, Effective Solar Solutions, by Efficient Home Services. With no upfront costs, you can save money on your utility bill and even eliminate your electric bill altogether with EHS Solar. Call EHS, the number one solar installer nationwide. We know how to customize your home. EHS handles every project in-house with no subcontractors. Remember, no upfront costs, tax breaks, and the best company in the business, Efficient Home Services. Schedule an appointment today at 727-353-3757. Visit our website and download your free buyer's guide to going solar at www.goehs.com. Go solar, go savings, go EHS. Call 727-353-3757 today to talk to our experts.
Are you an author, an artist, an inventor? Then you need to protect your valuable intellectual property. You need Larson & Larson. We have the experience and knowledge to help you with all of your legal needs, from processing trademark, copyright, or patent applications, to negotiating licensing agreements and handling litigation. The attorneys at Larson & Larson in Largo, Florida, can help protect you. Call us today for a no-cost consultation at 727-546-0660 or visit our website at LarsonPatentLaw.com.
Do you dread being called on to speak at meetings or family functions? Have you envied those who can sway an audience with well-chosen words? Do you know that people who speak well earn more money, earn more recording careers? Gain the confidence to master any speaking situation. Toastmasters will allow you to find your voice. Go to Toastmasters.org to locate the club nearest you.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Hi, this is Patsy with a Z, and I am back with my next guest. And this is quite a very special guest because everybody practically in America knows or has seen her. Karen Grassel has written a book called Bright Lights, Prairie Dust, Reflections on Life, Loss, and Love from Little House's Ma. And I'm so happy to welcome you to the program today, Karen.
Thank you so much. Patsy with a Z.
Yes.
It's Grassley.
Grassley. Okay. It is, you know, you. If it's for me, I come to this interview in a strange way because I actually never saw the television series. I was out of the country, living overseas, and when it was on, I never saw it. And then I did work, I will say I worked in Hollywood for a little while, and I'm just going to say this without any explanation, but I never, ever saw a Michael Landon movie or anything that he did. So I'm coming at this all, you know, so I know it's so different from everybody else because I think everybody in America at some time in their lives watched this very, very popular series.
Well, Patsy, I understand what you're saying. In fact, I have a number of friends here in the Bay Area who never saw the show because they weren't raising children during those years. Their lives were full and exciting, and that was also the case with many people in show business in Hollywood. So even though in the heart of the country, many, many people were watching, it wasn't universal. And the same was true for me, Patsy, in the sense that in my early life, I wasn't watching popular culture because I was in the theater. And I hardly ever watched anything on television. So So when they called me and said, you know, we want you to go and meet Michael Landon, I said, well, which one of the boys was he?
Well, you know, first of all, I want to mention that, you know, your name is not really well known. Grassley is not a name that people really knew. All they knew was that you were the mother. You were the mother on Little House on the Prairie, and your whole personality was built around that, and that what people saw. But as you said, you've done, and as I, you know, when I read the book, I realized how many things you have done in your life.
Yes, it's been a very full and interesting life, I have to say. And as you know, I started out in California as a young kid, and then I fell in love with the theater. And that took me to New York and to London and to theaters all over this country. Before I ever did Little House on the Prairie.
So what was, well, I will have to talk about Little House on the Prairie because that is the major thing that people know you about. What was it like this first, you know, interview, the audition? Did you have to audition against other actresses?
Actually, it was very strange because there were no other actresses in the waiting room, and I was used to being in a waiting room with quite a number of other actresses looking similar to me, wondering maybe I should have chosen to wear more like what they were wearing and feeling, you know, competitive and nervous. But on this day, I was the only person. And I found out later that the reason for that was they had already seen everybody in Hollywood that was the right type for this character. So they were down to the wire, and here came this actress who the agent said was out from New York and whom they had never met and never heard of, and in I went, and there was Michael Landon looking fantastic, and Ed Friendly, his co-producer who had brought the show to him, looking tan and wonderful. And the casting director introduced me to them, and they said, as they always do, tell us a little about yourself. And so I launched into my story, which was studying in London and then coming back and finally getting my Broadway debut and having the show close in 5 days, and then being brought out from the East Coast for a film in Hollywood that fell through. And so there I was, with no job in Hollywood and no prospects. And we all laughed and chuckled over these hard luck stories. And then before I got they had called and said, have her come back and pick up the scenes we want her to read tomorrow.
Wow. That's exciting.
It was exciting. So I did just that. And the next day, Michael read with me. He got right down on the floor. I was sitting on the couch, and he looked right at me. It was quite distracting. You know, he's very charismatic. And I just held on to those scenes, and we did the first one, and he said, good. And then we did the second one, and Patsy, I want to tell you, he leapt off the floor like a jack-in-the-box and yelled, send her to wardrobe. It was unbelievable. I was just stunned, and I thought, oh, my God, did I just get the part? And then there was a pause because it turned out that they needed to get network approval because, as you said, no one had ever heard of Karen Grassley.
And
hello?
Yeah, we had a little, like, you faded away there for a minute, but I heard that part that no one had ever heard about you. And in Hollywood, that's always a brave thing. They're not always brave to take on an unknown.
Right, right. So anyway, I got the part and we moved on.
Are you? Is your phone okay there? We're having a breakup here. Can you hear me, Karen?
I don't know. I'm talking to you, but I don't know what problem you're having.
Okay. Well, continue talking. We just had a little, somehow like a little gap. I don't know. But we're listening to you.
Okay.
So tell us about the first day you filming and meeting the family. What was that like?
Okay. Well, I think one of the reasons that people might enjoy my story is it shows that if you're willing to learn and willing to take chances, that your life can really take off. And I had a lot of challenges not ever having done primetime television. We were shooting it like a film, and that was all new to me, being out on location in the mountains, in the snow. It was a thrilling, thrilling experience, and I detail that in the book. And I also talk about my personal struggles as I was dealing with alcoholism, as the show went on and the hours were long and the trials were difficult. And I was now, you know, well-known and dealing with lots of publicity. And so I could reflect on that first day when I was just an innocent climbing up onto that wagon. And just like Carolyn, I was launching into an entirely unknown new life. And I could relate to her saying goodbye to her parents, whom she might never see again, knowing that her little girls were in the back of that wagon and not knowing what kind of danger they were going to run into. So my regard for the character began to grow right on that first day.
Now, you come from a background where your father was an alcoholic. Were you an alcoholic? How old were you when you started that day? You started?
I think I was 33 when we started Little House.
So had you already had a problem with alcohol by then?
Well, I seem to have been keeping it under control before then. I think it was a combination of things. One was I never had enough money. And one was that in the theater, I would never have ever considered having a drink before I went to work. So my discipline and my interest in my craft had kind of kept me on the straight and narrow. And I'd had a few bad times, you know, when I went to a party and my behavior spiraled down. But it really didn't start to add up until I was working those hours and under those pressures in Hollywood. And, you know, you do read about a lot of actors hitting bottom in Hollywood. And it's because the hours are so long, the work is so hard, you just can't keep it up. It just beats you up. And you have to give up.
Well, I've been on location with some filming, and I know that it is a stressful and very difficult work that people don't appreciate when they're watching a film. It all looks so easy, but it is a very stressful place. And particularly, I would think this show, because of just because you have horses and wagons and all of this other stuff to deal with, that, you know, if it was a contemporary work, it's not quite as complex to work with all of this, the things that you had to work with.
Well, I was very, very lucky because Mike had a wonderful relationship with his unit manager, Kent McRae. And Kent had been on years and years of Westerns, and he knew how to run a series. And our show ran like clockwork. Occasionally, we had a problem because an animal wouldn't go to sleep when it was supposed to or something like that. But you could really rely on this crew, on Mike, and on Kent to see that everything was there when it needed to be there, unless, you know, it was an act of God or something. So, actually, Little House was one of the best shows to be on because you could count on it. And the hours were shorter because there were children in it. And so they had to let the children go at a certain time each day. And then you were out of light, you know. So really, when I would look at what some of the stars of detective series, for example, were doing, working in downtown L.A. in the middle of the night, it was much tougher, I think.
Well, when you were, so when did your drinking get out of control while you were on the program, or?
Yes, it did. I relied more and more on alcohol to calm me down in the evening, to nurse my hurt feelings after the second season when Monk didn't want to renegotiate my contract, and the various ways that he punished me to try to bring me into line. And that caused me to sort of sink into a glass of wine and more glasses of wine and a lot of self-pity. And that was a very toxic mixture.
Well, I can't understand why he wouldn't want to renew your contract. I mean, you were so popular from day one. I've just been talking to people. And I went back. I had to look at a few episodes, you know, to prepare for this. But as I said, I didn't follow the series from the beginning, so I didn't know anything about all of this. But from talking to people, I think from day one, you were, like, very, very popular.
I think so. The whole show was very popular, and it was very common, Patsy. If a show succeeded, then the actors got to renegotiate based on the fact that they were a hit. The original contract with an unknown actor like me was very minimal. But my agent said, well, don't worry, if the show makes it, then we renegotiate. So it wasn't like it was anything unusual. And so I never understood why he gave me such a hard time about it.
When I look at it, and as I was reading about it, it doesn't make sense, because it's exactly what you said. Everybody, when they start a series, they're willing to go in, sort of lowball their fees, and with the expectation, if it's going to be a success, you're going to go up. And he didn't want to. I mean, what was his problem?
I wish I knew. I never did understand what that was all about. But I'll tell you, it went on for over a year. And it was extremely painful to be ostracized, to be punished, to be told that, you know, I wasn't that popular a character, to be told you have to have parity with the girls. After all the years of experience and training that I had, I just didn't think that that was true. And, of course, with little girls, their mother, one of them, the mother kicked her home and said, well, she's sick, she can't come in. And then they settled her contract. And the other girl had no favored nations, which means that any raises that any of the other girl got, she automatically got. So they didn't have to fight. And I look back on it now and I think, gosh, maybe I should have had the flu, saved myself a lot of trouble.
Well, I do not think the series would have been a success if you would have walked out, you know, and they would have had to get somebody else, because you were there. I mean, you were the mother. There's no way they could have replaced you, actually. I mean, maybe they would
have. No, I don't think so.
You know, he would have had to find, you know, somebody to shoot you or something, and that would destroy the whole idea of the series, this loving series, you know, of this beautiful family.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. But, you know, my lawyer and I thought that the best course of action was for me to come to work every day, to be a professional, to do my job to the very best of my ability. And I believed that if I did that, Mike would settle down and settle the contract. But it took over a year.
Well, I hope I don't know if what you did with residuals and all of that.
Well, we did very well with residuals. I want you to know.
That's good.
And I was the only actor of all those supporting actors, you know, all those wonderful characters. I was the only one who got a really great residual deal, and that was because I held out for it.
Well, see, that's...
I had to hold out, and I had to pay a heavy price.
Well, I'm glad you're getting good residuals, because this series apparently is playing somewhere all the time.
After all these years, our residuals dwindle, even my good deal. I mean, you can get a check for 29 cents, you know, but it's not about that, because over the years, it gives you the opportunity to build some security. You know, if you watch your money and you're moderate in your lifestyle, you can build security and you can have time to sit down and write a memoir.
And, well, you've come out of it. You've come out, and your life is good now. You've overcome the problems with alcohol. And I think you're trying now to be an inspiration to other people, too. Right?
That's exactly right, Betsy. I think my story can actually be of use to other people and other families, and bring hope and courage.
Well, I agree. I think it's a very, some parts of the memoir are very painful to read, but it will help people to understand their own predicaments in life and to see that you can overcome all sorts of problems, and you certainly did, and with grace and dignity that you're now, you know, going out there, and you've written this book called Bright Lights, Prairie Dust, Reflections on Life, Loss, and Love from Little Houses, Ma. And I just want to tell people that I think they will enjoy this book and learn from it and be inspired by you.
Thank you so much. If people are curious about how to get it, they can check my website, KarenGrassley.net.
Okay, well, I will continue to promote this book, and I'm so glad
Thank
that
you.
You joined me today. And as I said,
it's a pleasure.
It's a very well-written memoir, and I think everyone will enjoy reading it. Again, Karen Grassley, thank you so much for being on Joy on Paper.
Thanks, Patsy.
Okay, bye-bye now.
Bye.
Whoa, what a life. I'm going to tell you, I never saw Michael Landon on screen at all, ever, never. You might, if you read this book, you might understand why. Okay, I have a little problem. I want to do a Jim Lamb. I want to do a Jim Lamb literary gem for you. I made a mistake, and somehow I didn't send the right thing in. So we're going to play one that we've played before. But all of you NaNoWriMo people can go also to my website, radio-joyonpaper, and I put up the new one, Protagonist, and it is already up there, or Antagonist. I think I put up Antagonist. I'm going to put up Protagonist, and it's all of these things that you need to know. There's metaphors, there's this, and there. Oh, which one do we have now? Big Ed, let's cue that one in, okay?
It was the best of times. It was the worst of times. That, my friend, is the way to open a novel. I'm Jim Lamb. Let's get started. Who knows what Charles Dickens was thinking when he penned his famous and memorable opening to A Tale of Two Cities. Whatever it was, he was right on. The only opening line more famous, and even older, is from the Torah. Barashit bara Elohim et hashamayim ve'et ha'eretz. What does it mean? I'll give you a hint. In the beginning, God created. Well-crafted openings grab readers' attention and set up a great story. Let's take Jane Austen's Pride and Prejudice, for example. It is a truth universally acknowledged that a single man in possession of a good fortune must be in want of a wife. If you're familiar with Austin's book, you know what a perfect setup that is. How about Anna Karenina by Leo Tolstoy? Happy families are all alike. Every unhappy family is unhappy in its own way. That, my friends, is a riddle wrapped up in an enigma with a side order of fries. French fries. One of my favorite books is George Orwell's 1984, so it must have a great opener. You bet your big brother's life it does. It was a bright, cold day in April, and the clocks were striking 13. Wait a minute. 12 is the highest number a clock can strike. Or is it? The Stranger by Albert Camus has a short and not very sweet opening. Here it is. Mother died today. Kinda odd, yet suitable in every way. And of course I gotta bring up Hemingway's Old Man and the Sea. I always do. He was a man who fished alone in a skiff in the Gulf Stream, and he had gone 84 days now without taking a fish. If you can find a better opening to a book written by a Nobel Prize-winning author, let me know. I'm Jim Lamb, and you've just learned a little something-something about opening lines.
And boy, oh boy, all you NaNoWriMo writers, that is something to think about because you need a great opening line. And it's funny also what Patricia Dunn said, characters take over. So as you're writing and you find yourself with a great character, somebody who just grabs you, and sometimes they do grab you, run with it. Just have fun and make it memorable because you will be so proud of yourself at the end of November when you can say, I did it. I wrote a novel in 1 month. Right now, Carol J. Perry is trying to Carol J. Perry, who is working on her 12th novel in the Witch City Mysteries, is trying to write, well, she is probably writing 1,000 words a day because she is dedicated and she perseveres and she works through it all. And that's what writers learn. They have to continue writing even when everything else around them is going crazy. They have to continue writing. And so I just want to tell all of you people at NaNoWriMo, try to do as much as you can before Thanksgiving. That was my biggest problem when I was doing it. I couldn't write during Thanksgiving because I had lots of people, which was fun. Remember what I always tell you. One of the joys of life is to see your words on paper or to hear them spoken in an audible book. Or if you're very, very lucky to hear those magic words, lights, camera, action, and your book will be turned into a major motion picture, streaming video, or perhaps a series on the Hallmark Channel. You never know, and you won't know unless you start writing. And say something nice to somebody today. I will say something nice to Big Ed in the control room. Thank you, Big Ed, and thank you for pulling up the Little House in the Prairie theme song. I forgot to tell you to do that, and he reads my mind. He's so brilliant. And again, and he saluted me. I'll salute him because I should have been a general. I would have been the best general. Oh, I want to go to the war college, everybody. Bye-bye.
WTAN, Clearwater.
FM 106.1.
WDCF, Dade City.
FM 102.3.
WZHR, Zephyr.